Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. The program's also available at WKAR.org, and we want to welcome all of our online listeners as well. Always great to hear from you. Your feedback to our segments, your story ideas, always welcome at currentstate@wkar.org. It's a Wednesday here in East Lansing, and there's movement in both Lansing and Washington, D.C. toward what many call a leveling of the playing field regarding sales taxes. A pair of measures dubbed the Main Street Fairness Bill is currently being debated in the Michigan House. That proposal would collect a 6% Michigan sales tax on purchases from out-of-state internet retailers at the point of sale. And on Monday, the U.S. Senate widely approved a measure that would empower states to do just that. Supporters like the Michigan Retailers Association call such legislation a matter of fairness. And here to make the case for it, Tom Scott, Senior Vice President of the Michigan Retailers Association. Nice to see you. Welcome to Current State.
I see you, Mark. Thank you very much. It's really important to discuss this issue because the more that the people of Michigan understand how important this issue is to our economy and how unfair the current system is, the better off we'll all be. We can make some important changes.
Currently, buyers are supposed to voluntarily declare their online purchases on their taxes, and lo and behold, that's not working. How about that? So it's time to automatically levy the tax at the point of sale. Is that basically it?
That is basically it. A sale is a sale is a sale, and no matter where that sale takes place, whether it's in a store, whether it's over the internet, the retailer should be required to play by the same rules, and that is collect the tax and remit it to the state.
And that is the heart of your fairness claim here. That is the fairness that needs to be established in the system.
Absolutely, because right now under the current system, government policy rewards one type of retailer over another. It gives a benefit to out-of-state retailers who haven't invested in Michigan, they haven't created any jobs in Michigan, they don't pay any taxes in Michigan, and they're getting an advantage over our Michigan-based retailers, which are the heart of their communities.
We're talking Amazon, eBay, sure. Overstock.com. Those are some of the names that are arguably the biggest scofflaws here as far as you're concerned.
Absolutely.
Okay. And how big a problem is it? How much competitive advantage would your members derive from the passage of this legislation?
Well,
is it really going to be noticeable in terms of revenue and all of that good stuff?
Well, on an everyday basis, our Michigan-based retailers, they face a 6% price disadvantage right out of the gate.
Right.
They know all about competition. They compete every day. And they're willing to compete against out-of-state internet retailers. But what they tell us is, they can compete on price, but then they can't eat that extra 6% on a large item such as, musical instrument or even furniture, that is just a killer, and they can't do it. So they lose the sale. Because they lose sales, they can't create more jobs, and also at the same time, the state is losing the sales tax. So it's lose-lose all the way around.
Can you remind our listeners where the Michigan sales tax revenue goes exactly? What is that spent on?
Well, the bulk of it goes to support schools. It goes to public education. And I think it's 70-some percent goes to schools, and then the majority of the remainder goes to local governments.
Has a state government desk jockey calculated how much revenue is being lost?
Sure.
You happen to know that?
Absolutely, yes. State Treasury, they estimate that from all remote sales, as they're called, which is internet sales and also catalog and some other types, but anything that's being a remote seller who's not collecting the sales tax, it's going to be almost $500 million in the next fiscal year.
Okay. And since the name of your association is not the Michigan Brick and Mortar Retailers Association, I feel obligated to ask, does your association not represent any online retailers in the state of Michigan?
Oh, no, we do.
You do? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Because this, because most of the Michigan-based businesses are brick and mortar, this sometimes gets represented as brick and mortar versus internet. But it's really not that issue. It's Michigan-based businesses versus out-of-state Michigan businesses. Because a Michigan business, an e-commerce business, when they sell something to a resident in Michigan, they have to collect the 6% sales tax because they have a physical presence in Michigan. Their business is in Michigan.
What's called the nexus, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That's the nexus. They have a physical presence in the state
right.
of Michigan.
It's only the retailers such as Amazon that are out of state, do not have a physical presence in Michigan. They're the ones who can get away with not collecting the sales tax.
Your group says, quote, during the last holiday season, internet sales grew by 11% in the United States compared to only 3% for total retail sales. 11% on the net, 3% total retail sales. So a dramatic percentage of the increase in any sales increase, at least over the holiday season, would appear to be internet spending.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And, you know, it's no surprise that internet sales are growing faster than you know, brick and mortar. We see that all the time. More and more people are shopping that way. But that's all the more reason to have everybody on a level playing field so that everybody's competing under the same rules.
Some people are struck by the vastly higher prices of items in brick and mortar stores compared to the internet, and they make the claim that there's more in play here than just the sales tax to account for these dramatic price differences. Any response to that?
Well, it's going to depend. I mean, the retail industry is huge. You'll find some retailers who, will price things better than others. I mean, that's certainly no secret. So, again, it's very competitive. Everybody competes. What all we're saying is let's have everybody compete under the same rules, collect and remit the sales tax.
Are you willing to look into the tea leaves here and speculate how the House is going to move on this? Do you expect them to move on it?
Talking about the U.S. House?
The Michigan House.
Oh, the Michigan House. Yeah, we think the prospects are very good. This is our number one legislative issue. It was last session, and it is again this session. We've made great strides in helping legislators understand the bill's sponsors, Eileen Kowal and Rob Verheulen. They've done a really great job. And earlier this year, the House Republicans, of course, who control the House, they put it on their action agenda. So it's in committee. We had a hearing last week. We expect one more hearing, and then we expect that they'll move it out to the floor, and we expect the full House to pass it.
Are you getting much resistance? And if so, from where?
You know, there's still a little bit of resistance, but there is overwhelming support for it. You know, and there are there's some opponents out there, some critics. One of the main issues we hear is, well, you know, this is a new tax. Well, it's not a new tax, because if you buy something from an Amazon, you're still supposed to remit that tax yourself. It's just that Amazon is not collecting, so it doesn't get collected. So
that's your response to tax cynics who say, hey, this is just another opportunity for government to jack up revenue here.
But, you know, it's not a new tax. It's a tax enforcement. It's a tax collection issue that really should be taken care of administratively, but because of the laws, it needs to be done legislatively.
What do you say to people who claim that an item might not be available in a store and that the selection online is just a whole lot greater, and why penalize an online buyer with a tax for just being a price conscious shopper?
Well, I mean,
that must come up.
Yeah, but it's a little bit of an overstatement, because every retailer is different. Their inventories are different. If anything, this current situation has led to the situation where brick and mortars have had to be more economical, cut their spending, maybe have smaller inventories. So if we'd had a fair system from the beginning, it might be on a little more equal footing.
What's your longer term strategy for your brick and mortar members here? We just pointed out the stats from last Christmas. If internet sales were to take off
right
outside the Christmas season, outside the holiday season, is dramatically...
Which they do.
they are. Okay.
They are.
Okay.
And again, that's...
I'm asking. They are taking off it's increasingly popular to buy online outside of the holiday season as it is in the holiday season?
Almost. I mean, obviously, still the holiday season is still the biggest.
Okay.
But the growth is throughout the year because, again, some people see it as more convenient. And that's the challenge for a brick-and-mortar retailer. You have to create a absolutely great experience for the customer. You have to provide products that aren't just a commodity, something different. You have to provide great service, so it's not just, some anonymous mail transaction. The one benefit, of course, that the in-store retailers have is you go, you look at the merchandise, you purchase it, you take it home.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait for FedEx
a week.
Or UPS,
yeah.
So it's great. And of course, all good brick and mortar retailers also have an online component. They also have an e-commerce component.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
And there are ways to work that where you can order online and pick it up at the store. So, there are some advantages there.
One last question. Why is action at the federal level important? How important is the action going on in Washington, D.C. to this cause?
It is important because Congress, under a Supreme Court decision, Congress is the only one that can actually solve the entire problem. Because with their legislation, they can make this apply to everyone.
Okay.
They can make it apply to the internet retailers, the catalog retailers, whatever. Our bill in Michigan is still important because, first of all, there's no guarantee that we're going to get congressional action. The Senate passed it Monday, but there's no guarantee the House is going to take it up. And now we hear House Speaker Boehner saying, he's really not supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, we can't just sit around in Michigan waiting for Congress to act. What the Michigan law does is redefine nexus, what a physical presence is, so that it captures more of these internet retailers. But it doesn't capture all. It's only a portion of it. So we need Michigan to take a first step. Michigan is among like 24 other states that have taken some kind of action.
Right.
The more the states take action, the more that's going to push Congress to give us the final solution. But it's important in Michigan that we take that first step.
Tom Scott is Senior Vice President of the Michigan Retailers Association. We've been talking about the Main Street Fairness Bill. Thanks, Tom. Good luck.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. A unique state government agency is celebrating an important milestone today. The Michigan Historical Commission is holding its 100th anniversary meeting in Lansing. The group is the commission is the group responsible for the more than 1,700 green and gold historic markers scattered across the state. I love them. I've often stopped. They're intriguing. I don't stop as often as I'd like, but I'm glad they're there. It's also heavily involved in the ongoing sesquicentennial of Michigan's role in the U.S. Civil War. And here to talk about the importance of preserving Michigan's history is the chair of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey. Mr. Dempsey, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me.
One of the commission's main tasks is approving the text for all of the Michigan historical markers you often see on roadsides or in front of significant buildings, and there are more than 1,700 of them across the state. I understand the public asks for a marker. How does that process work from there?
They fill out an application, submit an application fee, and then it goes through a process of research, investigation, verification of the historical accuracy of the site or the person or the story. And then it comes before the commission. We review the accuracy, the heavyweightness of the marker, approve it, review the text, approve the text, and then most often go out and help dedicate the marker. And beyond that, now we're looking at trying to carry the program up another notch by trying to facilitate things like mobile phone apps so that people could not just read the text on the marker, but go deeper into the story associated with that site.
That's great. How often do, now how many applications do you get over the course of a typical year? 2013, how many do you expect to get?
Probably, I would say a couple dozen. Last year we approved about that many, which was quite significant. And I think there's a growing interest across Michigan, as you just indicated, with these kinds of stories and sites. The other thing the commission's doing is looking for additional mysteries that haven't been brought to light and doing its own, on its own initiative, looking for sites, stories, individuals that we should commemorate. And so we are partnering with some groups to try to make that happen, like the conservation folks, the civil rights folks, to try to create virtual trails, so to speak. Trails are a big thing in Michigan right now.
Yeah.
So if we could stitch all these together, get people traveling around Michigan to look into our heritage and become more educated about it, I think it will really benefit the people of Michigan.
I think you're alluding to the commission's Hidden History Initiative. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, Hidden History. And this is just overlooked. Often episodes in Michigan's history involving environment, involving civil rights, and so on.
So the Civil War story, many Michiganders are not aware of the role that Michigan played in the American Civil War, which was dramatic, significant, one of the critical elements in helping our nation stay together.
Mm-hmm. How many applications do you turn down as a percentage?
Very few, actually, because most people that are wanting to do a marker have a really significant story to tell. It's the rare one that comes in that isn't really appropriate.
Okay.
How's that for a good euphemism?
I'm really tempted to go deeper on that, but
I'll have me back and I'll talk about that.
Rejected applications for Michigan historical sites. Sounds like a segment. What keeps historical events from being overlooked or forgotten? How is it something relevant can just sit there for decades and then somebody bring it up again, reappreciate it?
I think it's because we're into storytelling, but over time people forget to carry those stories on. And so something that is well known a generation ago or even a century ago, as we celebrate our centennial today, it's just lost. And when it's rediscovered, people are shocked and amazed because of the quality, the depth, the amazing nature of those stories. Like in Detroit, we have Capitol Park because that's where our first state capitol was.
Yeah.
And in that park was buried our first governor. But over time, because of the way the park was designed and conditions in Detroit, that got to be forgotten. And we helped bring that story to light a few years ago and continue to do that.
That was when Stevens T. Mason's body lay in state at the Capitol, correct?
That's correct, exactly.
October of 2010, while crews worked to restore his tomb in Detroit. We're in the midst of the sesquicentennial of the U.S. Civil War. Here at WKAR, we've reported on several major battles of the war, and the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg is coming up in July. What's the commission doing both in and out of the state to observe Michigan's role in the Civil War?
We have put on conferences in the state with the help of partners. We go around the state telling the story. We have a book that was authored that the author proceeds are contributing to the commemoration, because we get no appropriations. In fact, the nine commissioners, each of whom is just a tremendous asset to history, gets no reimbursement, no remuneration for expenses. So we raise money privately. Out of the state, one of the great things we're trying to do is erect a monument to Michigan's sacrifice at the Battle of Antietam. And then in July, two commissioners will go to the Gettysburg area to dedicate a historical marker there. You mentioned we have 1,700 around Michigan. Actually, most are in Michigan, but a few are in other states, and one is in Europe.
Ooh, We need a story there. Tell us about the Michigan Historical Marker in Europe.
Well, I wish I could. I don't remember exactly what it is.
Oh.
But see, that's one of those stories that I need to have on the tip of my tongue, and it would be fascinating to tell you. Have me back, and I'll tell you about it.
Maybe it's Normandy. I mean, Normandy is the first thing that comes to mind.
I don't believe it's associated with the Second World War.
Oh, no? Okay. People often see history as a finished event that's happened in the past, and once it's written in the books, it's over and done. But time and again, new research and evidence comes up that sheds new information on the past. Do you feel this program is doing everything it can to keep the past alive? What would you change about the program if you could change one thing?
The marker program? We would do more to publicize it, more to promote it. Having 1,700 markers in the ground is terrific, but as I said, connecting them to today's younger generation with mobile app device content, having more of a presence online, having more sponsorships. We're more than willing to work with, you know, private partners to get more funding for this program because, again, it does not get appropriation support from the government.
What do you know about how history is addressed in other states? Do they tend to invest more in this area than Michigan or less or what?
Most states, I would say, are similar to Michigan, but a number do invest more heavily. Because of the Civil War sesquicentennial, some states like Virginia are spending several million dollars on their history effort. Tennessee is another example. In Ohio, next door to us, they've had significant cutbacks, but their public-private partnership is very strong, and that's something that we need to continue to improve here in Michigan. I would say after 100 years, we've gone through a deep valley over the last several years with what happened in state government with Michigan history programs, and today we're coming out of that abyss, and so the prospects for our appreciating our history, our heritage, are much brighter than they were a few years ago.
And what? How do you mark the occasion here later today?
We have a regular meeting that starts at 10. We are going to break at noon for a commemorative luncheon. We are releasing a review of the 100 years of public investment in history, a booklet. We're going to have a cake, a Sanders Bumpy cake, which they're celebrating their 100th year in being in business. So we're going to have some festivities at noon and continue to work on our vision for the future of history in Michigan.
This has been very interesting. We've been talking about the importance of preserving Michigan's history. The chair of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth says if you got a cut, it can't be in public safety. We'll talk about that. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment, one book, Greater Lansing, getting books in the hands of needy kids. That's all on the way on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stay close. Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Detroit Lions just continue to have a problem with law enforcement, ironically enough, as Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth sits across from me here today. I read now on Twitter that former Lions receiver Titus Young was arrested not once, but twice on Sunday. So there's a problem. There would appear to be a problem here with the Detroit Lions or guys who become players of the Detroit Lions. I'll tell you, that is just amazing how ongoing that situation is. In a speech Monday night at the Michigan Law Enforcement Officers Candlelight Memorial Service held at the state capitol, Longtime Ingham County Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth minced few words when describing the toll that politics and budget cuts have taken on law enforcement in the state. And Sheriff Rigglesworth joins us now to expand on his comments from the other night and to discuss the effects of downsizing police departments. Welcome, Sheriff Rigglesworth.
It's great to be here and good to see you, Mark.
What exactly did you say the other night, and what led to those, to your comments?
Well, my point was, in general, nationwide, there's been a huge cut in law enforcement. If you look here in Michigan, look what's happened to the Detroit Police Department, the Flint Police Department, Saginaw Police Department now have to have state police patrolling their cities because they don't have enough police officers to stem the tide. Here in Ingham County, Lansing PD is about half what they used to be. The sheriff's office, we lost 33 positions 3 years ago. I now have 14 deputies to patrol 13 townships in the rural areas of the county. It's hard to put together a meaningful law enforcement program when you have those kind of numbers. Now, keep in mind, the sheriff also has to guard prisoners that are in the hospital. So
yes,
if the city has a prisoner that gets arrested for something and has to go to the hospital, we have to guard them. That comes from our road patrol. So there are days we have literally no deputies on the road because they're otherwise handling other details.
Now, what impact has that had on the crime rate?
Well, you haven't seen a significant uptick yet, but you're starting to see more crimes of violence. You take a look at the last few weeks in Holt. We've had a couple of home invasions that have been significant. You're seeing those kind of things in Lansing as well. So the criminals are starting to get the message that there's going to be a slow response.
What are your conversations like with legislators and other elected officials when you're discussing this?
Well, in general, they plead poverty. We don't have the money, so therefore we have to cut.
And I
understand budgets. I mean, I'm not naive. I used to sit on school board. I understand you have to live within your budget. But you have to pick what you're going to cut. And I think in the grand scheme of things, if you don't have a safe community, people aren't going to live there. They're going to move out. And you're seeing that time and again in these communities where people feel unsafe. They're fleeing to the suburbs. And as well, try to get business in a community that's not safe.
How do you decide what to trim, though, when there's such a shortage of revenue? What do you trim instead of public safety?
Well, that's not my decision, but I'm going to tell you this, Mark. There are areas in the county and there are areas in the cities that took no cuts. Most county services are non-mandatory. They're discretionary.
Okay. With these cuts, there has to be backlogs. What are some of the areas that tend to become overwhelmed? I know you've voiced concerns over the years about the county jail. Is the operation of the county jail under control right now, to your satisfaction?
Well, of course it's under control. I mean, you have to deal that within the law. So if you have too many people in the jail, you declare an emergency and you start throwing people out, and we do that frequently.
You do?
Well, yeah,
okay.
And we have a portion of the jail that's closed. Due to budget cuts. We got a post that would go to hold another 63 people that has nobody in it.
I'd like to talk a minute about guns. Do conceal and carry laws allow police officers to do their jobs more effectively or less effectively?
Well, I'm not sure that has a significant effect on law enforcement. I mean, you're talking about because more people can carry guns now, how does it affect law enforcement?
Yeah.
I haven't seen a significant problem there. Normal people having a gun isn't a big deal, and we haven't experienced that. The problem, Mark, is very simple. Under Michigan law, if you have been adjudged mentally ill, it precludes you from getting a weapon or a carry permit. But there's no way to check that.
Okay.
So if you come in, you've been judged insane by your doctor, you come in and we ask you a question, have you ever been judged mentally ill? Well, of course I haven't. Well, then we have to issue a permit. It's that simple. There's no database that allows us to check you out.
What needs to happen with regard to background checks then? They need to be tightened up.
They need to be tightened up, and the mental health issue is the part that's missing.
Okay. Are there other suggestions you have for reforms with regard to gun laws? This is still a pretty hot topic.
Well, I'm not sure why John Q. Citizen needs these high-capacity magazines. It's a mystery to me. But even with that said, I think it's important to point out, if you had a low-capacity magazine, let's say a magazine that held 6, 8, 10 bullets, you could still have a half a dozen of those and pretty much accomplish the same thing. So that's an issue that somehow has to be sorted out. Other than that, my comments here are going to make no difference in this debate. I don't think Congress has got the spine to take this issue on, and we're going to be talking about this 10, 15, 20 years from now.
The Lansing State Journal reports this morning on the Michigan Department of Corrections plan to trim its budget and reduce its overtime payroll costs. DOC has more employees leaving the department than new officers coming in. Any take on this, on the state's correctional challenges?
Well, that's been a challenge for years.
Yeah.
They have a new director, and I think he's trying to take them in a little different direction. I applaud him for his efforts. We do need to lock criminals up. And as I said, we have part of our jail that's not even being used that causes great angst for our local judges because they can't put them in. So collectively, the state and local, we need to clean up our act when it comes to housing prisoners and how we're going to go about that.
About a week ago, the group Fight Crime, Invest in Kids was at the Capitol urging the legislature to expand Medicaid in Michigan. Their claim is that health coverage for expectant moms helps prevent babies born with fetal alcohol syndrome. They also support it to enhance various interventions involving substance abuse and mental health issues. Do you agree with – there were a lot of law enforcement professionals in this group. I know Kay Hoffman, Lansing Township Police Chief, was in this group.
I'm part of this group.
You are part of this group. Okay. And you are sold on expanding Medicaid for that very reason.
Absolutely. Every study you can read will show you that early intervention when it comes to neonatal care and preschool care, these type of things, if you can intervene early, the chances of these children becoming productive citizens is increased exponentially. Not a little bit, but a lot.
I've noticed there's a Facebook page that's launched called Dissolve Lansing Township, and they maintain that the members of this group maintain it's time to incorporate the scattered pieces of that township into the city, into other units of government. How does this pressure to consolidate impact your capacity to protect and serve here in Ingham County?
Really doesn't have any effect. Lansing Township is an interesting piece of geography when it comes to fire protection and police protection. There's a chunk here and a chunk there, and of course they got the Eastwood Town Center, which dominates a lot of their law enforcement time now, but I wouldn't see it having a significant effect on what happens at the sheriff's office.
What do you, I have to ask you about drone technology. I don't think there's a week that goes by that I don't read something related to this. What do you make of it? And is there a day when the county may purchase and use drone technology?
Well, I view this debate with some humor. I mean, we've been flying over people's houses for years. I mean, when we have a problem, we call the state police. They send their helicopter. We use it to find kids. We use it to find elderly people who have wandered away from nursing homes. So even though it's not a drone, it's flown by a live person, it accomplishes the same thing. Now, the naysayers on drones, what would they say if they had a child that was kidnapped and we needed to search an area that the state police helicopter wasn't available for or something, but yet we had a drone? Would they say, no, you shouldn't do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a relatively cheap technology. I think it has many applications. I just don't understand what the concern is. They're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
Well, there's privacy concerns, I think, that people have raised.
Well, you can fly over houses now,
and,
Mark.
And do that already.
Absolutely can do it.
How big a problem is meth in Ingham County?
It's huge.
What's the trend? Is it just an ongoing problem that is not getting any better?
The trend is the one-pot cook method. In other words, they take a 2-liter Coke bottle and they can do this stuff in the trunk of their car. And we catch people for that on a weekly basis. Eaton County, I have a son of the sergeant over there, and they deal with it almost on a daily basis. They go out doing meth sweeps two or three times a year and just grab up people that are cooking meth. So it's a problem.
Where is the marijuana discussion in terms of law enforcement right now in the county?
Well, the big issue that we're facing when it comes to marijuana, and since it's been, quote, legalized by licensing and so on, is robberies. The users know where the growers are, and so they go there and rob them. And we've had two in Delhi Township just in the last week. So they're stop and rob kind of operations, and they're difficult to deal with.
It's budget season. What's the dynamics of the budget discussion right now in Ingham County with regard to the to your department?
Well, we're putting our budget together. We're going to ask for a few new toys, but won't be significant. There won't be a significant change in our budget.
What are the new toys?
Well, I'm a couple of positions here, those kind of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's primarily manpower.
Yes.
And do you know where the commissioners are in terms of budgeting for police for your department in the county?
I don't. You need to keep in mind the county controller is retiring, and she's been a strong leader, Mary Lanois. She'd be gone here in June. And so they're in the process of hiring a new person that will drive that train. So those are all dynamics that we have to deal with.
But you're going to be watching who replaces Mary in that position, because they do play a key role with regard to your funding.
Well, I don't know if watching would be the appropriate word. We'll be working with that person.
It's an important person in terms of the budgeting process.
It's a huge player in county government.
Okay. Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth has joined us here this morning to talk about police budgets and when did we reach the point where they've been cut too much. Thanks, Gene. Appreciate your visit.
You're welcome.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make Greater Lansing a better place. This week we feature a new organization, the Greater Lansing Chapter of First Book. It's a nonprofit that offers new books to children in need. And here to tell us more about First Book and what it's been like getting it off the ground, Board Chairperson Jeremiah Rivera. Good morning, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Mark.
And Chair-elect Paul Harmon.
Good to be here, Mark.
Hi, Paul. Tell us about First Book. This is a national organization, from what I understand, Jeremiah.
Yeah, so First Book was founded in 1992 by our current CEO and president, Kyle Zimmer, and since then has distributed over 100 million brand-new books to local programs that serve disadvantaged children across the United States and Canada. So First Book Greater Lansing, which Paul and I represent, has been in existence since October of 2012, so we are a brand-new organization. We're a completely volunteer group. First Book has over 170 different advisory boards across the country.
Okay.
So we're one of the newest ones.
How many states have a First? Are they in all 50 states?
They're spread across all 50 states.
And Kyle is your national guy, your national administrator.
Kyle Zimmer is she is our.
She. Oh, okay.
She's our CEO and president, and also the founder of First Book.
Okay. Paul, tell us about the people you serve exactly.
Yeah, so, Mark, what we're trying to do in the Lansing area, I'm from the Lansing area, grew up. Jeremiah's from Texas. He's kind of an import for us here in the Lansing area, graciously helping us out.
Okay.
But what we're trying to do is work with local area schools, local area different organizations that work with disadvantaged children. And what we try to do is offer them to purchase books from what is called the First Book Marketplace. And what they what that marketplace does is it discounts books pretty heavily. So the average children's book would cost between $2.50 to $4 per book versus, you know, if you went out to an Amazon or something, you're paying the cover price for the book. And so what we've been doing in the Lansing area, some of the organizations we've been working with, we've met with the Capital Area Community Services Head Start Program.
Okay.
Lansing Public Schools, Big Brothers Big Sisters, the Greater Lansing Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And so we're, like we said, new, so we're trying to get as many of those organizations registered with First Book as we can. And then once they're registered, they can start taking advantage of that marketplace, as well as funds that are available for grants. So not only are they have the ability to purchase reduced books, but sometimes they can get even further subsidies with grants that the local chapters offer as well as national sometimes offers.
And these are primary elementary age kids older?
Our primary focus getting started, it's kind of up to each advisory board kind of where we start. We actually have books in the marketplace that range all the way from pre-K through 18. So they have books for getting ready for the SATs or ACTs.
Oh my. Okay.
That are pretty discounted as
well. The name First Book kind of intrigued me. So I'm thinking, I thought maybe we were dealing primarily with younger kids.
That actually kind of goes back to the nature of working with disadvantaged children. So we're working with kids with organizations that are working with kids that may not actually own any books at home that are age appropriate.
I see.
So these books that, for example, Big Brothers Big Sisters might distribute to their littles, might actually be the first books that these kids actually own.
I see.
So that's where that name comes from.
Jeremiah, what made you get involved in this group?
I am actually have been a big for the last 2.5 years, and just in a casual conversation with my case manager, it asked how many children weren't matched at the time, and it was over 200, and this was about 2 years ago. And I wanted to do more, but obviously I'm not going to be able to have an individual mentor relationship with 200 children. So it just all kind of came together because within the next 2 or 3 days, I was on my Twitter account and found an article about First Book. And I did a search to see, was there already a advisory board in the area? There are actually two advisory boards in Michigan, both based on campuses at University of Michigan and Central Michigan. But there wasn't one in Lansing. And it just seemed like a no-brainer. The first thing I went to was went to Paul, who I've worked with at the state of Michigan. We're both state of Michigan employees. We had a good rapport. And Paul is also very civic-minded. And when he told me that he thought this would be a good fit for Lansing, and just went from there. And we have some amazing people on our board, very dedicated. We're all volunteers, and they're all putting so much time and effort to getting these books into the hands of kids that need them the most.
Since the other chapters in Michigan are in university mm-hmm. chapters, have you connected with MSU?
We have, yep. We have two representatives that sit on our board from the MSU campus, two students, and we're excited that they've started a volunteer drive for future events for us, and as we continue to do some fundraising goals and things, they're going to be a very great resource for us here in East Lansing.
What's it like to start a local chapter of a national organization?
It was very interesting. I think the hardest part for me was finding, I think the mission is pretty easy to explain. You're not going to find many people that say, well, I'm kind of against giving new books to kids that don't have any. That's pretty easy sell. The hard part was finding people who would be dedicated and driven, because it is volunteer. I'm not hitting people over the head with hammers, getting them to do work. These are people that they accept an assignment, and they do it. And it's been very rewarding. Our first milestone that we're looking to get was enough money to do about 1,000 books in the area. And our first major donation doubled that. So it's been an interesting and exciting to see just in the greater Lansing area how excited people are about helping the children here.
And there's no shortage of worthy recipients
of
the books. Just the Big Brothers Big Sisters account dramatizes that, I think. Mm-hmm. A waiting list of a couple hundred, I beg your pardon, just about all the time.
Right.
Is the larger community learning about First Book?
They are, but in a couple different ways. We're on social media. We're trying to get our word out, word of mouth, trying to attend as many free luncheons and dinners that we can to kind of get the message out. But being very new in October, I think coming on to shows like yours, Mark, is going to be a big benefit to us to try to get the word out. There are other programs that work in connecting books with children. A little bit of the difference between that and what we do is what we ask is that as a recipient or purchased on the marketplace or a recipient of a book grant from us, that book get used in some kind of a curriculum within the organization, whether it be, you know, a weekend read fest or, you know, an actual science book that gets used in the classroom, that it's actually used for an educational purpose. And then at the end of the day, the child gets to take that book home and add it to a home library.
What's next, Jeremiah? What would you like to get done in the next 6 months or so?
So immediately, the next goal is to have our first book grant cycle, which we plan on doing in June. So we're going to reach out to our recipient groups like Head Start and let them know they can start planning on applying for that. We want to give out enough money to do about 2,000 books over the next 6 months. That represents about half our fundraising goal. So just kind of that quick recap, we do want to do that first book grant cycle, but we're also only halfway to where we want to be for the rest of the year. So we do want to continue our fundraising efforts beyond that.
What do you need? I presume you need volunteers. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can people become involved in First Book in
sure.
Lansing?
So as Paul mentioned, we have our social media site. So you can go to facebook.com. It's /First Book Greater Lansing. Our webpage is our Facebook page. They can go to our traditional website, which is firstbook.org/Greater Lansing. And there's you'll find more information about us in an email that you can reach Paul and myself at if people want to volunteer. They can also donate at that site as well.
And if a group wants to be a recipient of your services, mm-hmm. receive books, how do they go about that?
Yep, contact us as well. And there's an application at the firstbook.org website that they fill out to become part of that, part of the recipient group list. We encourage them to do that, definitely, and we'll be happy to answer emails as well if they respond to our email list on firstbook.org/Greater Lansing.
Jeremiah Rivera and Paul Harmon are two of the leaders of the Greater Lansing chapter of First Book, which will offer new books to children in need. Thanks for joining Current State today.
Thank you, Mark.
And we could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work in the Lansing area. We just don't know about them. So if you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss prison privatization in Michigan. And to balance out the prison talk, we'll have live ukulele music throughout the show. Saturday, Lansing Old Town will host its second annual Mighty Uke Day. Event organizers and musicians join us in studio tomorrow. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer, thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry as well, and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State here on WKAR.